It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Federal Communications Commission just extended its deadline for public comment on its net neutrality proposals because their website was overwhelmed with traffic and crashed. A telecommunications expert discusses this and other news on net neutrality.
First, Sarah Ganser, a 12-year-old from Appleton, is cutting her week at summer camp short to go to the White House. She's going along with her mother to meet with the First Lady, Michelle Obama.
Sarah won the First Lady's National Kids Recipe Contest with her recipe for amazing African sweet potato stew. The contest was part of Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, which encourages kids to eat healthy foods and stay active.
We spoke with Sarah and her mom, Jennifer Ganser, earlier this week about the recipe and upcoming trip to the White House. Jennifer, where did you find out about the competition in the first place?
I am always looking for on healthy recipes, and I'm looking on websites. And the Michelle Obama Let's Move website advertised it. And I had seen it last year and didn't enter, and then saw they were having it again, and I thought, well, let's go for it.
And as I understand it, you had to develop, did you have to develop your own recipe, or could you modify an existing one?
You could modify an existing one.
So how did you develop the one that you submitted? And tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, originally, I got the recipe from a friend, and it was super spicy and really good, but my kids just didn't go for it just because of the super spiciness. So we made some changes, added some extra spices, and took out some of the cayenne pepper, or made it, you know, if you wanted to put it on there. And so we tried it out, and it tasted great. My kids liked it, and so we thought, let's go for it.
And Sarah, this is an African sweet potato soup. Tell us a little bit about your role in developing the recipe.
Well, we got it from a friend, and then it was originally, like, really spicy. So we changed it to make it kid-friendly because a lot of kids don't like it really spicy. So I like it. I personally don't like the spiciness, so I like it just the kid version.
So you're a chief taste tester. Tell us a little bit about what's in the soup. Give us a rundown of some of the ingredients.
Well, some of the ingredients are sweet potatoes, peanut butter, there's ginger, garlic, red peppers, onions, allspice, cumin, brown sugar, cinnamon.
Wow. That's a lot going on there. And of all the recipes that you could have chosen to develop and submit to the White House, why did you settle on the African sweet potato soup? And I'll toss that to Jennifer.
Well, it's unique, and it's affordable. That's one of the criteria. And super healthy. There's beans in there with a lot of fiber and protein, and the sweet potatoes have tons of vitamins, and it's just a powerhouse for vitamins and minerals and fiber and protein. So I thought this would be excellent recipe.
And had you considered other recipes beforehand?
Yeah, we did. We have, you know, we have quite a few recipes we enjoy here that are healthy, and just thought this would be a good one. I have another daughter who also submitted a taco soup recipe as well that wasn't picked. So we had actually submitted two of them.
Well, who's cooking this up for you at the White House when you head there later this week? Is this something that you get to actually have a hand in making, or will there be one of President Obama's official chefs making this up for you?
Yes, they will. They'll have the chefs making it, but all the food that we're going to eat at the state lunch is are the recipes that have been submitted by the kids. So that'll be fun to try some other recipes.
And Sarah, do you cook often? Is this something that you've been doing for a while now?
Yeah, I love to cook, and I cook often because it's one of my hobbies that I really like.
How did you get into it?
Well, my mom cooks a lot, so I just kind of picked it up from her and like started helping her, and then now I'm cooking by myself.
Mm-hmm. And do you have your own garden, too? Do you supply your own vegetables?
Yeah, we have a garden, too. Yes.
Nice. And Jennifer, when it comes to getting your kids involved in cooking, was it hard to make it as sort of an attractive hobby for Sarah, or did she gravitate toward it naturally?
She gravitated to it naturally. We love to have family meals, and we try, you know, when we can. Most nights, actually, we do eat together and we cook together. And it's just something that we like to do just to, you know, be together. And so I have four daughters total, and so we always have lots of fun in the kitchen. And it's a bonding time as well.
Yeah, definitely. What kinds of things do you like to make traditionally? Are African cuisines part of the normal rotation of meals in your house, or what else are you making?
Yeah, we love all kinds of ethnic foods, actually. Mm-hmm. We find that foods from over the world actually tend to be healthier than the typical American diet. So we love to cook Indian food, Thai food, African food, and just foods with lots of vegetables and fruits and spices we tend to gravitate towards.
Sarah, what's your favorite dish that you make as a family?
I like the vegetable stir fry we make.
Tell us a little bit more about what's in it.
There's a lot of veggies, and you just, I don't know, stir fry it, and it tastes really good with the sauce, and yeah.
Just a nice classic basic stir fry.
Yeah.
Sounds simple enough too, and wonderful in the summer months.
Yes, it is.
Jennifer, a lot of parents struggle to get their kids to eat healthy, and I'm wondering if you have any advice for not only parents getting their kids to, you know, pick up a vegetable or two instead of the candy bar or whatever might be tempting them, but also to get them engaged in sort of family cooking and healthy eating.
Sure. One thing is just to keep offering healthy foods. Always have fruits and vegetables to offer every time you eat. You know, typically, it takes a child 3 to 5 times to try something before they actually start liking it, and usually they will. You know, as long as you modify it, you know, with, you know, the spiciness of it all. Another thing is to find recipes you think that you might like, and be creative and go for it, and experiment in the kitchen and try cooking your own food. It's so much healthier to cook your own foods instead of going out for dinner. And then also, it's just fun to be together in the kitchen and have your family dinner. Another thing we like to do is go to the farmers markets and look at all the wonderful produce there and buy local foods. It's super healthy, and it's just a fun time also. And people who normally don't eat lots of vegetables and fruits don't realize how good they taste and how good you feel after you really have a healthy dinner. And once you start doing that, then you're kind of hooked, and you don't want to go back to the way things were.
Yeah, well, and I think a lot of parents, too, they come home from work, they've got the kids in tow, and they're tired, and they feel like there's not a lot of time to be stepping aside from the normal routine to do that, especially if it's not part of their normal routine. Do you have any perspective on that, on how to, are there quick recipes that families can turn to, or other ways to get around the time trap?
Absolutely. I have four kids, and we're super busy, so one thing I like to do is prepare my veggies on the weekends. I'll cut them up. I can put them in individual snack bags so they're ready to go. Cut up your fruit. Crock pots are another great thing. Throw the ingredients in the crock pot. You come home and it's all ready for you. And then there's, you know, great cookbooks out there for, you know, dinners, 5 ingredients or less. There's all kinds of neat recipes that you can quickly throw together and make a meal. And it's not as hard as people think. And it's so much healthier.
And Sarah, as I understand it, you're heading to summer camp this week, and it sounds like you're leaving, you know, a pretty tasty kitchen table there with your mom and your siblings, and heading out to someplace where I don't know what kind of food they're serving you. Do you ever feel like you want to kind of step back and teach other people how to make some tasty meals, even at summer camp?
Yeah, I like to tell other people about, you know, the healthy stuff you can eat, and how they can change their diet to make it healthier.
And tell us about your forthcoming trip to Washington, D.C. You're going to be leaving this week and actually missing a little bit of summer camp for that. I wonder what the other kids are going to think when they say when they find out where you're headed this weekend.
Yeah. I'm really excited for Washington, D.C. because, you know, we get to see the White House garden and eat lunch with Michelle Obama and the 53 other winners from all the states and territories.
Wow. And what else is in the plan there? Do you have special activities that are also in concert with this dinner?
Yeah, we get to go see museums and just meet other people from around the nation. Mm-hmm. That'll be fun.
And I understand that your recipe will be published as well, so other people can enjoy it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I like that it can other people can make it and enjoy the healthy, fun recipe, and I just love sharing it with everyone.
Where can we find it?
You can find it on the website. There's a cookbook, and then my recipe will be in there.
Nice. And Jennifer, as going forward, you know, even after this excitement of the competition is over, what ways do you hope to expand the, you know, the recipe basket at your house, the collection of recipes to keep inventing new dishes?
Well, we're always constantly trying to find healthy foods and recipes, and I'm excited actually to hear about more of Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign and talk to the schools about it. And my job is in healthcare, and I'm excited to be able to bring home the message and just talk to other people in our community about healthy eating and childhood obesity and moving more.
That's so great. Well, both of you have a great time in Washington, D.C., and congratulations on winning that contest.
Thank you.
We spoke with Sarah and Jennifer Ganser earlier this week. Sarah is a 12-year-old from Appleton, and she won the First Lady Michelle Obama's National Kids Recipe Contest. She heads to Washington with her mom today for the kids' state dinner.
The Federal Communications Commission, FCC, just extended the public comment period on their net neutrality proposal because their site received so much traffic, it apparently crashed. They've received almost 800,000 public comments on these proposed regulations, still collecting comments until Friday at midnight.
Barry Orton is with us to discuss what consumers are saying about net neutrality and to explain the current plan in place. He's a professor of telecommunications at UW-Madison. Professor Orton, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start out with a general reminder. I think it's been a little while, at least, since we've covered this on Central Time. What's the latest on the net neutrality case?
The latest is the Federal Communications Commission has proposed rules, and it is opened for comments on those new rules, and those comments, because they did crash the server and have come in such great numbers, have now been extended until Friday at midnight. So it's still not too late to comment on the net neutrality rules, which I'll explain in a second. The way you comment is you go to www.fcc.gov/comments. And the very first one you see would be number 14-28. And that would be, you click on that and you get a place to put in your name and so on, and a big blank space to write your comments. So, what is net neutrality? It's the idea that the owners of pieces of the internet service providers, in which for most people are either a phone company, a cable company, a satellite provider, in some cases a separate local internet service provider, those providers cannot discriminate between signals between different kinds of sources of information on the internet, but have to treat each the same depending on what kind of service they are. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has tried now in the last 10 years three different times to classify the internet in such a way that it could set it up to be essentially fair, that each individual cable subscriber or internet subscriber would essentially have access to all the things available on the internet on an equal basis. Three times the courts have turned them down and said the way they have done it is not legal and not statutorily supported. So we're now on trial number four. The commissioner or the chairman of the commission, Thomas Wheeler, has proposed a system whereby there will be a certain number of carriers that will be in what's called a fast lane, which can be essentially a method by which they provide signals that are essentially privileged and will go get to your home faster at a more quick and efficient route, essentially. And this would be for services like Netflix, which is already paying for Comcast to carry it on a similar kind of basis so that its subscribers have their signals coming in at a fast enough rate that the signal doesn't stop or break down or lose its definition. Other providers, such as YouTube, which didn't pay for that privileged position, would go on the regular at the regular speed, and theoretically, anyway, their signal could have less of quality than those that are paying for the more privileged bandwidth. Now, there's been an enormous pushback on that, as you can imagine. And because the internet had been previously set up on a common carrier basis, which is the way telephone lines work, and that's essentially a first-come, first-served, treat everybody equally and reasonably basis, and that's essentially the free and open internet that we had kind of learned to depend on over the years. And so that would essentially change. And the pushback, particularly from consumers and from individuals and companies that wouldn't be in this kind of privileged position, has been enormous. And so the FCC has extended the comment period. And at this point, there is no single thing that they have gotten more comments on.
I was reading about that. And okay, so Forbes had reported as well that 36 internet companies, including Google, Netflix, and Amazon, had urged the FCC in a memo to not, it seems as though they're saying, do not go in this way. The internet is threatened by broadband internet access providers who would turn the open best efforts internet into a pay for priority platform more closely resembling cable television than today's internet.
Correct.
My question about that, though, is that these big mega companies that exist on the internet, Amazon, Netflix, Google, they seem to be the types of companies that would benefit from this type of thing. So what's the grounds for their concern?
They would benefit in the fact that they have enough money to pay for the prioritization. But they would prefer not to have any prioritization, or at least not on this basis. Most of the people who are arguing against this proposal, and that's all it is at this point, is a proposal, are saying that the FCC should do something far more robust, and that they should put the internet under what's called Title II, Roman numeral II, which is common carrier status, which is the status that telephone systems have now. And that would essentially make the internet not quite a free-for-all, but at least a everybody is equal kind of situation, and then the FCC would have at least the legal authority to make those kinds of rules stick. At this point, every other way it's tried, the courts have said, no, you don't have the legal authority, and no matter what they do, the very large carriers like Verizon, AT&T, and the large cable companies are likely to sue if there isn't a robust legal platform under the whatever rules the FCC ultimately passes. This is a political issue. Make no mistake about it. The big companies that would benefit from this are trying to argue that their First Amendment rights would be trampled upon if the FCC went to this more robust Title II common carriage kind of platform.
And we'll certainly talk more about this after the news. But real quickly, I'm wondering if the public awareness of the not just what this issue is, but the implications of it had been as great as it seemed to be after John Oliver on his HBO show kind of did a bit on it that went viral. And he gave very specific instructions on how to engage the FCC and submit comments. And that's right. When we started, I think that's when we saw the first crash of the website. What's your response to that?
Well, this is an issue that is very technically detailed and legally detailed, and the average consumer gets lost in it very, very quickly. Oliver did a very good job of making it extremely simple and putting on a very amusing rant, and people watched it and said, yes, he's right. I don't want these big companies to control the internet. And so they clicked on fcc.gov/comments, and at least once they seem to have crashed the server. Mm-hmm. But at this point, the server is up and running and taking comments. And the more comments on this, the better. The more public interest, the better. This is big corporations cutting up the cake, and the cake being the...
Professor Orton, we'll pick that up after the news. We're talking with Barry Orton about the FCC's extension of public comment period on net neutrality.
You can join the conversation. Are you one of the 800,000 people who commented on this? Call in and tell us why and what you said. Share your thoughts and your questions on internet regulation. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We're continuing our conversation with Barry Orton about the influx of public comments to the FCC on net neutrality.
And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. Are you one of the 800,000 people who briefly helped crash the FCC website with your comments on this issue? What do you want the FCC to know? What you think about the way the internet should be regulated? Do you think, as they propose, the people who own the wires, the tubes, as they've been called, should be able to charge higher rates for faster access to some, slower access for others? Or should it be first come, first serve, equal for everyone? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
Professor Orton, before the news, you were saying that the more comments, the better in this process. And as we mentioned, nearly 800,000 comments have been submitted, I guess, by our last estimation. I'm wondering the process, though, for reviewing these comments and how it will lead to an eventual decision.
Well, there's a bunch of staffers who are going through these and probably categorizing them as pro, con, from and who they're from in terms of socioeconomic background and so on, as best they can. These get summarized and go to the commissioners who get to vote on this. This is by no means the end if you don't do it by Friday, because then there's another comment period that lets people comment on the comments, so that if you take umbrage at something that AT&T said, or you look at the comments, and of course they're all public, that you don't like what Comcast said, you have a chance to refute it, and that's going to go on through the summer. So this is a very long, convoluted legal process that culminates in a vote on the actual proposed rule by the five commissioners, three of which are Democrats, two of which are Republicans. There probably will be a 3-2 vote, but the commissioner, the chairman, has to get both Democrats to agree with him, and one or more of them might want him to go further, and depending on how many comments and how much pressure they get. They're getting these comments, they're getting lobbied by lots of individuals and lots of companies, and where the dust settles at this point, nobody really has a good sense of yet. But the sense is there's lots of money at play, and the bigger corporations that are involved in this are really lobbying it very heavily. And the next step is, if they don't like what happens at the FCC, they can go to court on it, or they could try to get Congress to pass a more specific rule and force the FCC to do something. And that right now is what's going on in the House. There's a House bill today that would defund the FCC from doing specific things on net neutrality. It's not going to pass, or if it passes, it certainly won't pass the Senate. But there's political pressure going on, as well as enormous money pressure from every side in this.
And FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler was formerly a lobbyist for the industry and industry head for the cable industry and later for the cellular industry, as I understand
right.
it. So how does that play into the conversation? A lot of people are concerned about that.
Well, a lot of people say that even though he's the chair and he's a Democrat and he's been appointed by the president and he's pushing a more pro-net neutrality stance than others might have, he's an industry captive. And he made his fortune in both of those industries, primarily lobbying the very same agency he is now running. But this is nothing new. The past half dozen FCC chairs all came from industry, more or less, and many of them went back to industry. The current chair of the National Cable Association used to be the FCC chair, under the in the Bush administration, Michael Powell, the son of General Colin Powell. Now he's arguing for the industry, and he was the one who set up the original net neutrality rules under the scheme that turned out to be illegal in the first place because it wasn't robust enough. The arm's length between the industries that the FCC regulates and the industry and the FCC commissioners is a very short arm.
Let's talk to Doug in Lancaster. Hi, Doug.
Hi there. You touched on just exactly what I was thinking with regards to not only the current FCC chairman, but the previous FCC chairman, who is now in league with the lobby groups that are lobbying for net neutrality. This is all about money, and our government is truly an oligarchy. Take a look at all our past Secretary of the Treasury, who are now working at Goldman Sachs and the big Wall Street firms. This is no different. The people will speak. They'll crash the website again probably this week, but nobody will listen. It will go to Congress, as you guys are alluding to, and we won't be listened to yet again. I did make my voice heard. I'm proud to have said I did. I hope it amounts to something, but sadly, I'm not optimistic. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. What's your response to that, Professor Orton? Is there reason to be optimistic at all?
I'm somewhat optimistic in that this is now on the public agenda as a real item. And so there is debate and there is discussion, which is far more than it had been before. And I think that's a good thing. But whether there's equality of decision-making in terms of my voice versus Comcast's voice, I don't have anywhere near their kind of clout. And I think this goes in a lot of areas. This is nothing new in our system. What individuals have to do is band together and any way they can. There are a lot of large organizations getting involved in this on all sides and to make your voices heard. But in the lobbying business of Washington, money talks.
Thanks again for that call, Doug. Jen in Cedarburg is next. Hi, Jen.
Hi. You know, as far as I'm concerned, corporations can pay for having faster speeds if they want, as long as the base speed that everybody else gets is 10 megabits per second or greater. Today, everybody in America is suffering with an archaic technology. We're about the slowest speeds in the entire world for our internet transmissions. And if they were significantly higher to what the rest of the world is capable of, we would probably not complain about this. It's all about speed is really what it comes down to. Nobody wants to get stuck at the horrible speed ratings of DSL today or even cable of today. There are countries around the world that have speeds 3, 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 times faster than what we have in America here, and they don't pay half of what we pay. Americans are getting screwed badly by the corporations on this topic, and it really comes down to the speed that we get, not who controls the speed or what speed companies that pay lots of money get.
Okay. Well, thanks for that comment. Professor Orton, what's your response?
My response is, yes, that's true, but, and of course, his big if is, if we all had high speed, it wouldn't matter, but we don't, and it doesn't look like we're going to in the near future, and so bandwidth is somewhat limited in most cases today. And so it does make a big difference if you're going to be downloading a Netflix movie and Netflix or versus a Hulu, and Hulu doesn't pay for preferred access and Netflix does, your Netflix is going to look a lot better. So it's still a matter of getting what you're paying for, and those who pay more get better. That doesn't change very much. But at this point, the controlling element of that is at the FCC, and the FCC does have the legal power to assert its authority and say these inequitable situations can only be done if they're done reasonably and done under controlled circumstances. The companies involved really want very little or no control. That gives them total control.
You had talked about how this is an issue that's cropped up a couple of times, and this time is obviously it's getting a lot more of a public interest than previously. How do you think this will unfold ultimately?
Well, I think many telecommunications lawyers will be able to put their children through expensive private colleges as a result of the work they'll get litigating this.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Professor Barry Orton, Professor of Telecommunications at UW-Madison. A team of scientists recently found the coldest, faintest white dwarf star ever discovered.
You might imagine that discovering previously unidentified objects in the vast universe is hard enough. Now imagine finding something like this, a dying star that's invisible to our telescopes.
David Kaplan is an assistant professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. He was part of the team of scientists who found the white dwarf. He joins us now from our studios in Milwaukee. Professor Kaplan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
For us non-astronomers, remind us what a white dwarf actually is.
So a white dwarf is what happens when you take a star like our sun and wait about 5 billion more years. Most of the star goes away, but what's left is all the stuff that's in our sun. It collapses down to about the size of the Earth.
And have we named this white dwarf star yet, this new one?
Well, since we haven't really seen it itself, it doesn't get a name quite yet. We only have named the object that it orbits around, which is a particular pulsar, which is a neutron star. So we've named that, but even that name isn't very creative. We just sort of name it after the latitude and longitude where we find it in the sky.
Wow. I'm fascinated by that right there. How do you measure the latitude and longitude in the sky?
Well, we have to know where to point our telescopes to look at this thing. So we assign a latitude and longitude to all the different stars that we observe in the sky. So you might know that if you go out at night right now, you can look up and you can see Vega, and it's sort of, you know, roughly where to look or something like that. But if you want to point the Hubble Space Telescope or something like that, you need to know much more accurately exactly where to point it. So just like we have a way to assign a specific latitude and longitude to every spot on the Earth, we do the same thing in the sky. And so we have to measure the position very, very precisely, and that's a whole technique in itself. So we did it here using a network of telescopes called the Very Long Baseline Array. And that includes 10 different telescopes, radio telescopes, that are spread everywhere from Hawaii throughout the continental U.S. onto the Virgin Islands. And we combine the signals from all of them, and that tells us extremely precisely where this star is.
So we can't see the star. So how, using all those telescopes, how do you know it's there?
Well, we don't see the white dwarf, but we see the pulsar that it orbits around. And so the pulsar is, as I said, it's a neutron star, and it emits very regular blips of radio waves. So if you had a big enough television antenna, you could point your television antenna at this pulsar, and 30 times a second, you'd get a little blip of radio waves. Now, it has to be a very, very big radio antenna. We use something called the Green Bank Telescope, which is in West Virginia, which is about the size of a football field. And when we point that at this particular patch of sky, we get a little blip every 30 milliseconds or so.
And that came from the white dwarf?
No, that's coming from the pulsar.
Okay.
And the pulsar is orbiting around the white dwarf in a little binary system. Every 2.5 days, they orbit around each other.
And so the white dwarf changes the properties of the pulsar blip, and that's how we're figuring out where and what it is?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, as I said, they're orbiting around each other. So you can think of it sort of the white dwarf and the pulsar, they're both sort of orbiting around this point in the middle of the binary. And so sometimes the pulsar is a little further away from us, and then the white dwarf is closer to us, and sometimes it's reversed. The pulsar is close to us, and the white dwarf is further away. And what happens is when the pulsar is further away, it takes a little bit longer for its pulses to get to us. And we can measure that change. And when the pulsar is closer to us, the pulses come a little sooner, and we can measure that change. And so by looking at this change, sooner, further, we can figure out how massive the white dwarf is.
Now, you said the pulse was, I think, every 30 microseconds. When we're talking a little sooner and a little longer, how much of a difference are we talking about?
Well, the pulses come every 30 milliseconds, but they actually change by 10 seconds. Sometimes they're 10 seconds earlier, sometimes they're 10 seconds later. So you got to be really careful because you can't have the wrong pulse. We have to be able to count individual pulses. So if you start counting and say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and keep doing that where you have a different number every 30 milliseconds, You have to keep counting like that for about 3 years at a time without losing a single count in order to know when the pulses should come.
So who has to stand there counting?
Well, thankfully, we have computers and graduate students.
Excellent.
That's how it's done. So how do you estimate just how cold it is? I understand, as I've read, that this is the coldest, faintest white dwarf that that's been discovered thus far. How do you measure its temperature?
That's right. So you can think of it sort of like we're looking at the dying ember in a campfire. So when your campfire is going, the embers are very hot. And that's sort of like the center of a star when the star is burning gas. It's turning hydrogen into helium. But eventually, you put out your campfire, your star goes out, and it just gets cooler and cooler and cooler. So it starts out at about 100,000 degrees, and it cools down. In this case, it's been cooling for about 10 billion years. And the way we know how cold it is, you have to take into account two things that are very uncertain in astronomy. One is how far away things are. It's very hard to know whether you're seeing something that's a really, really bright star, but that's really far away, or a not-so-bright star, but that's pretty close by. And so that's always been a problem in astronomy. But in this case, we're lucky. That same network of telescopes, the Very Long Baseline Array, we're able to determine exactly how far away this star is. It's 867 light years away, or 5 quadrillion miles away. And so we know how far away it is. So we don't have this problem of knowing whether it's something very far away and bright or nearby and faint. But then we also have to know how big it is. And luckily, white dwarfs are a special kind of star where how big it is determined just by how much stuff there is, the mass of the white dwarf. And since we know that from the orbit of the pulsar, we know how big it is, and we know how far away it is, and we know that we don't see it yet. So you can combine those pieces of information to figure out that it's got to be colder than about 2,000 degrees.
Amazing. And the composition, I've read, this is a diamond-encrusted star at this point?
Not diamond-encrusted. The diamonds are all on the inside.
Hmm.
The outer maybe kilometer or so is made up of hydrogen gas. But the inside is made up of carbon and oxygen. And when you take carbon and you make a crystal out of it, what we call that on Earth is a diamond. Exactly what it looks like in the center of the star is probably a little bit weirder. The pressure at the center of the star is about 1 quintillion atmospheres. So we don't really know how things behave quite there. We can't really do experiments. But it's crystallized carbon. And so we can talk about it sort of over drinks. We can talk about it as a diamond that has one with 34 zero carats.
Wow.
Hmm. Well, what knowledge do you hope can be gained from the discovery of this particular white dwarf?
So that's a very good question. We use these white dwarfs, like I said, sort of like embers in a campfire. So if you think back to some Western movie, they'll be tracking some party and they'll come across a campfire and some tracker will lean down and feel the embers and they'll say, oh, they haven't been gone long. They've only been gone 2 hours. We can still catch them. We do the same thing. We use the temperature of these white dwarfs to figure out how long they've been cooling for. And the coldest white dwarfs have been cooling for the longest. We can actually use the temperature of the coldest white dwarfs to figure out the age of the universe and the age of the Milky Way galaxy that we live in. The problem with that is that this cooling process, it's not always easy to just sit down with a pen and paper or even a computer and figure out exactly how it works. It's sort of complicated. So what we need are calibration sources. We need objects where we can say, I know exactly how cold that is. I know exactly how old that is. I can use them to figure out everything else. And this star sits in a place where we don't have any other calibration sources, so that our goal is, by measuring how faint, how cold this is, and just what it looks like, which we hope to be able to do over the next year with the Hubble Space Telescope, we'll be able to use this to understand just how cold and just how old a whole bunch of other white dwarfs are and help them to do things like figure out how old the Milky Way galaxy is.
Wow, that's very fascinating. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you very much.
That's David Kaplan, Assistant Professor of Physics at UW-Milwaukee, talking about the coldest, faintest white dwarf star ever discovered.